I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Are you a reader? I'm not asking whether you have the ability to decode the lines, dots, and curves that form letters, to understand how those letters form words and those words sentences. And I'm not even asking if you're required to engage with written information in the course of your daily work by poring over reports, deciphering studies, or slogging through emails. I want to know if you're a reader. I mean, do you squeal with genuine delight when you receive a book as a gift? Do you claim to have an appointment, put your phone on Do Not Disturb, and steal 20 minutes in your day to finish the novel you've been reading because there is simply no way to make it to the end of your day without knowing what happens? Are there books piled by your bedside, stacked on your counters, and overtaking the corners of your living space? We wanted to know how you feel about books, and here's what you told us.
Desmond from Brooklyn, New York. I'm giving books about Black history and also about American history, particularly the 1619 Project, Howard Zinn's History of America. And these books are going to my children to be used as the extension of a library for my grandchildren in each family. And this because particularly the ones in Texas who are facing an environment where Black history and the atrocities that were committed against Indigenous, Black, and Hispanic folks are largely tried to be swept under the rug.
My cousin's son and daughter-in-law just had their first baby. I sent them three of my all-time favorite baby books, Snuggle Puppy by Sandra Boynton, 10 Little Fingers and 10 Little Toes, which is also you can start reading to your newborn baby immediately, and then for a little later on, Knuffle Bunny, an absolute classic for a toddler.
Lisa from Eugene, Oregon, gave my husband It's Trevor Noah, Born a Crime for Hanukkah. He loves it. I also gave him The Trees of Eugene by Whitey Lewick, very good local book. And I'm hoping I'll get the Gabaldon newest book, 9 of 9, Go Tell the Bees That I Am Gone. Books are the best.
As always, we really appreciate hearing from you. And it's pretty clear that the Takeaway community is full of readers. The shorter, colder, and darker the days, the more I just want to get under the covers of a snuggly blanket and between the covers of an engaging book. And for many of us, the best gift of the holiday season is to have a few more precious moments to tune out the world and dive in to a good book. Which is why this feels like a great moment for the Takeaway to talk about books. So grab a pen or open your notes app, because we're going to be giving you lots of titles to consider for your own reading or to give as gifts for the other readers in your lives. I almost feel like Oprah around holiday time. You get a book, you get a book, you get a book, you get all the books. We're going deep with books. And we're going to kick things off with an overview of some of the best and buzziest books of 2021.
I'm Constance Grady. I'm a senior culture reporter at Vox.
I asked Constance what makes a good book and whether it's just a personal reader-to-reader experience.
You know, I think on a certain level, it is a reader-to-reader experience. No one can tell you that a book you did not like is something that you have a responsibility to like, or vice versa. If you like a book and you love it, no one can take that away from you. But on the other hand, I think it is possible to say that a book is trying to do something really, really difficult and interesting and ambitious in a way that is worthwhile, even if it's not necessarily fun to read, that can still be really valuable and interesting to talk about.
That's an interesting point. Let's just dig on that for a second. Actually, and I want to phrase the question slightly differently as well. Are there some clear indicators of what makes a bad book? Like, no, that was bad.
Oh, absolutely. I think for me, a bad book is a book that is describing a reality that, first of all, doesn't exist, and second of all, would be boring if it did. You know, a book doesn't have to be a documentary. You have a lot of options to have flights of fancy and joy and imagining a world that is interesting and fun and that tells us something about our own world. But if you're just like putting out there boring lies, that's not interesting. No one needs that. No one needs to spend time there.
Yeah, I think I love that idea that, you know, even if it was well executed, nobody wants to hang out in that world is a really useful way to think about this. But one more beat on this. You talked about doing something ambitious, creative, or interesting. You know, I'm wondering if we're using kind of the Olympic grading scale here. So some books might absolutely accomplish and achieve something that's, you know, basically a cartwheel, right? Like, oh, that is one beautiful cartwheel. Another book might try something that's more like a Biles and maybe not like stick the landing, but whoa, even the attempt is valuable. Do you use that kind of a Olympic grading scale when thinking about book recommendations?
Yeah, that's such a good metaphor for this. I think that often the first question I ask myself when I'm reviewing a book is, what is this book trying to do? Did it succeed at that? And is the thing that it's trying to do worth accomplishing? And for me, if the thing that it's trying to do is really hard and really interesting and cool, then I'll often say, you know what? This is more compelling to me than a book that tries something very simple and does a pretty good job at it.
All right, so let's get into some books. The first book on the list is The Sentence. Can you tell us about it and why it stood out to you?
Yeah, so this is The Sentence by Louise Erdrich. This is her first book since winning the Pulitzer a few years ago. It is a really interesting book in part because it is set at the bookstore that she runs. Louise Erdrich is an Indigenous author and she runs a bookstore in the Twin Cities that specializes in Indigenous literature. So this book takes place at her bookshop. The main character is a clerk there who is an Indigenous woman who, as the book opens, has been tricked into using a dead body to transport drugs across state lines and ends up being incarcerated. So the sentence at the first refers to the sentence that she's serving in jail. She serves out her sentence. She gets her job at Louise Erdrich's bookstore, and she ends up realizing that she is being haunted by the ghost of a white woman who will not leave the bookstore. And it's this very funny, very tender sort of ghost story about this figure that she has a lot of vexed and confused feelings for. It's a metaphor for the relationship between Indigenous people and white people, but it's also just like this very funny and sweet and sad look at being alive and in a bookstore in this past pandemic year.
Yeah, I love so much about even just the sort of setup of this text and where you can go with a story like this. So this was definitely on my list as well. Now, the next one takes us to a very different kind of location and with a very different kind of lead. Talk to us about The Matrix by Lauren Groff.
Yes, this is a great book. So Matrix is the third book by Lauren Groff that was nominated for a National Book Award and didn't win. She told me she's thinking of herself as the Susan Lucci of the National Book Awards now. This book takes place in 12th century England. It is about medieval nuns who are building a separate isolationist community of their own in like the middle of nowhere in England where no men can come. One of the things I love about this book is it's very, very sensual in this way that you don't often see in books about women. It's very much about living in a woman's body rather than looking at women's bodies. So the description I keep thinking about is there's this passage where one of the nuns is going through menopause and she gets a hot flash. And so she runs out of the abbey in the middle of the night and goes and dives into this cool lake. And you get this really beautiful description of how hot she feels inside of her body. And then she gets into the water in the moonlight and it's very cool on her skin and such a palpable relief. And I don't think I've ever read a description of a hot flash in fiction before, certainly not one that was so visceral and stunning. And it's really not something I've seen before. It's really shocking and exciting to read.
I got to tell you that I'm so happy you picked out that scene. It made me think. So I'm married to a very bad but nonetheless devout Catholic husband who is particularly nervous in one church where we go to Mass because there are all of these basically naked angels painted around. And he's always like, this can't be happening in church. And so that moment, I thought, yeah, I feel like there's a certain like Catholic guilt audience. It's like, you know what? I can't. This is too far on the nuns.
Listen, nuns have bodies too. They go through menopause too.
Exactly. And I think for me, that's part of what makes it such a bit of a surprising pleasure of a text is that it's precisely those bodies that we want to not think of as bodies. So, you know, encountering it in that way is really lovely. So let's talk about Three Rooms. You know, again, if we think about the Virginia Woolf notion that every woman needs a room of her own, and I love this, you know, Z-Gen update that what we really need is an apartment of our own.
Yes, exactly. So this is a novel by Jo Hamya, and her main character is working in these like smart kid jobs that don't pay you anything. They just sort of pay in glamour. So at first she has a fellowship at Oxford. Later she gets a job as an assistant at a fancy London magazine. And all she wants is an actual apartment of her own where she'll have three rooms all to herself. And instead she is subletting a couch from this girl who kind of hates her. And it's this really beautiful evocation of the sort of millennial, zennial state of being stuck in this place where you have always sort of imagined that surely you can at least get your own apartment eventually. And then sort of going, can I? Is that actually going to happen? What is it like to come of age in this economy where things that previous generations have taken for granted just sort of are trailing steadily further and further out of reach? It's a really, really smart and beautifully written look at that dilemma.
Now, let's talk about Colson Whitehead. Colson Whitehead has never written anything that I didn't like, just didn't pull me in on the first sentence, and I could not put it down until the end. Talk about the newest book, Harlem Shuffle.
So Harlem Shuffle is Colson Whitehead's latest book after his previous two both won back-to-back Pulitzers. This is his chance to pull off a three-peat. Maybe he'll do it. It is an incredibly fun book. It is a heist novel about vengeance and respectability politics and colorism, but also it's just so fun to read. The main character is a furniture salesman in Harlem in the 50s. He is constantly sort of assuring everyone, including the reader, that he's not, you know, really crooked. He's on the straight and narrow. It's just like occasionally he moves some stuff around that he doesn't necessarily know where it came from. But he has a cousin who he's very close with, who definitely is a criminal. And he gets our main character involved in a plan to rob a luxury hotel. And it all goes wrong from there. It is just so much fun to read. I think you can really tell that Colson Whitehead is having the time of his life writing this. And it really just transfers into the text. It's just a blast, kind of a romp to go through.
I love that. Whitehead does. He just, do not pick up one of his books unless you have the time to read it, because you will end up missing all of the rest of your appointments for the day. One of the buzziest books of the year was The Other Black Girl.
So The Other Black Girl, it is a very, very chatty kind of conversational book. It sort of feels like you're talking to your girlfriend and she's walking you through how she feels about everything, probably more verbosely than most people's inner monologues go. What I liked about it is how increasingly loopy it gets. It starts off with the main character is an editorial assistant. She is working at a publishing house, and publishing is notoriously extremely white. I think the last statistic I saw was that it is 79% white people working in the industry. So our main character has always been the only Black employee at her publishing house, and then they hire another Black girl. And this new employee starts to kind of edge ahead of our girl in terms of office popularity and office politics. It's kind of an All About Eve situation. And you're like, oh, okay, I get it. It's a racial satire, All About Eve with race. Makes sense. And then it just starts to get progressively weirder. it's in a lot of ways similar to the Boots Riley movie, Sorry to Bother You, where it starts off as being about telemarketing and code switching. And you're kind of like, yeah, I get it. Makes sense. And then like halfway through, it's like, now people are turning into horses. What? It's just, it's very much a trip that goes in directions you will not expect. It gets weirder and weirder as it goes in ways that I really have to respect.
Now, your next pick is actually a translation, When We Cease to Understand the World. This actually revisiting kind of math and science concepts mm-hmm. that we learned in high school. Talk about that a bit.
Yeah. So When We Cease to Understand the World sort of mingles fiction and nonfiction. It is looking at chapter by chapter these concepts in math and science that seem to accurately describe the way the universe works, but don't really match with the way that we understand the world in our lived reality. So there's a chapter about Schwarzschild discovering the singularity at the middle of a black hole, right, where matter is as densely packed as a little pin and everything falls apart. And what the book is about is just how bizarre this idea is and how it should we should understand it as being very world-shaking. So Schwarzschild is like working out his equations and figuring out that this is something that necessarily has to exist in the trenches in World War I. And he's like forgetting to dodge bullets. And he's thinking like, oh, man. And then if you look in one direction, you would see time going extending infinitely back into the past, and from the other direction you would see the future extending infinitely forward, and there would and you would never be able to escape the singularity because it would always exist and matter would be curling in on itself like a dragon's tail. He's just constantly evoking this sense of cosmic awe that we kind of take for granted. I think a lot of us learn sort of hazily about concepts like, you know, black holes and electrons in high school science, and we're kind of like, okay, yeah, I don't really get it, but I'll sure that's probably true. And he's sort of saying, no, you should think about this and how very bizarre it is. And the question he's asking is whether, as we come to more and more understand the way the universe works and the way that doesn't really mesh with the our own experiences of the world, do we start to become alienated from our own sense of humanity?
I'm a fan. Last one here, and it is The Right to Sex, Feminism in the 21st Century.
Yeah, so this is a book of essays on post-Me Too feminism. I think feminism is one of the social movements that has gone through the most dramatic changes in the past decade. The way we talk about feminism in the mainstream right now is so different from the way we did just 10 years ago. So this book is sort of attempting to parse through some of the changes and make sense of them. One very difficult but impressive essay goes into the manifesto of the incel killer Elliot Rodgers and sort of parses out the sexual economics that are implied by his essay and then uses that to critique a larger state of sexual economic liberalism. She also goes into the author, Amiya Srinivasan, is a professor at Oxford, and she goes into her students' ambivalence about pornography being omnipresent. She puts that in context against the porn wars of second wave feminism and sort of looks at what we've gained and what we've lost in our conversation about pornography since then. It's a book that is asking some really, really hard questions and handling them very, very carefully and with a lot of nuance. I think even if you don't necessarily agree with Srinivasan's conclusions, it's really worth reading through to see how she's thinking about them.
Constance Grady, senior culture reporter at Vox, thank you for joining us and walking us through such great, great books.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi. Goddamn!
Those are the sounds of the legendary singer, songwriter, and activist Nina Simone. And that song, it was a response to the bloody brutality of the South. and no state was bloodier than Mississippi, where racist lynch mobs took the lives of nearly 600 people, mostly black men and women, during the first half of the 20th century. Now, two decades into the 21st century, the ongoing movement for black lives is pushing many to grapple with the continuing realities of state-sanctioned racial violence.
My name is Treva B. Lindsay, and I am the author of America Goddamn, Violence, Black Women, and the Struggle for Justice.
Treva Lindsay's new book asks us to confront the intersection of racial and gender violence by examining the stories and histories of violence against black women and girls, both cis and transgender. These are the stories of Ayanna Stanley Jones, Breonna Taylor, and Sandra Bland. But these are also the stories of the 4 in 10 black women experiencing violence from their intimate partners, and the more than 1 in 5 who endure rape. I asked Treva about the title of her forthcoming book, America Goddamn.
I am a Nina Simone stan, and I remember the first time I heard Nina Simone's Mississippi Goddamn, and it has that show-tune-y kind of vibe to it, but she is dragging and reading, and that for me was so incisive. And the fact that this is the first of her protest songs, that she is inspired by the assassination of Medgar Evers and the 16th Street Baptist church bombing in Birmingham that took the lives of Carol, Addie, Denise, and Cynthia, the 4 little girls, as well as severely injured Sarah, the sister of Addie. And so she was like, I need to say this. I need to indict America in these ways and be unrelenting in my critique and also so proud and forceful and dynamic in the praise of resistance. And then also thinking about that Jeremiah Wright moment of goddamn as a visceral reaction to the onslaught of violence against us and what it means when I hear yet another instance in which anti-blackness or misogyny noir or any other forms of inequality and equity manifest in such harmful and death-dealing ways, and how we are seemingly predisposed to premature death, either slowly or spectacularly. And goddamn became this framework for thinking through that and feeling through that. I didn't want to just be effective in this book. I wanted to be affective in this book to reach us in that feeling place, to honor the fact that the stakes are so high when we're talking about the ways that violence shows up in the lives of Black women and girls.
So you talk about how violence shows up in our lives, but I was struck just now as you were responding to the previous question, you were naming each of the girls who are killed in 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, by that white supremacist bomb. And it occurred to me, as you were saying their names, how infrequently we hear their names. They are typically simply defined as the 4 little girls. And I guess I've wondered, you know, the violence and racist violence has been meted out quite equitably between Black girls and boys, between Black men and women. And yet our ability to say his name, to reach back into our history and to find those moments, those kind of cognitive and emotional hooks so that we can understand what lynching is. So I can say Emmett Till. And so when Trayvon is killed, I have Emmett Till as a framework for understanding it. But if I can't even say their names, they're just 4 little girls. Does that make it harder for us to even discern the violence against Black girls and women in this moment?
Absolutely. I think understanding that history, and I'm reminded when we say her name, it is about, on one hand, that level of recognition, sure. But in addition to that, it's an accounting of someone who is beloved and in community with people. And so their names matter to people who love them, who were in community with them, who were living alongside them. And when we don't have an accounting that recognizes the ways that anti-Blackness shows up in the lives of people across Black genders, it is very devastating because we think then that this is exceptional rather than illustrative, rather than part of a larger pattern that we can date back through the transatlantic slave trade to see the kinds of violence that befell Black women's bodies on slave ships, or thinking about plantations, or thinking about Great Migration, the literal kinds of violence that was at stake from moving from one area of the nation to another, to thinking about these four little girls. And part of that acknowledgement of them as four little girls, I think, does speak to this idea of really honing in that these were little girls, these were young girls, and that attempt to not adultify the ways that we think about anti-Black violence. And on the other hand, there's a way that we don't say from Cynthia, Addie, Denise, Carol, to Renisha McBride or Ayanna Stanley Jones or Rhea Nelton or any of the other names that obviously have been victims of white supremacist fatal violence. And I think it's important in doing that naming so that we understand the gravity, the legacy, and the ongoing terror of anti-Black violence in the lives of people who are not cisgender Black men and boys, which is not a competing tension, but a more expansive way of thinking about violence.
There is one part that is certainly not competing, but is complicating. This text is not only about revealing violence of the state and of state-sanctioned violence by white supremacist actors who may not themselves be members of the state. It's also about the fact that girls and women and queer folk are subjected to both that kind of violence, but also violence within the community by Black men and boys. And you talk, for example, about the R. Kelly case. So can you walk us through maybe one of the clearer ways to say this is just, who is it? What is it that commits violence against Black girls, women?
Yes. And this was one of the hardest chapters to write in the book. And one of the things that I brought to the book, and I hope comes through when readers get their hands on it, was the personal and my own experiences with violence. And some of my first encounters with violence happened intracommunally. And the way that I wanted to talk about that was not bending into this pathologizing narrative around Black men as criminal, as aggressive, et cetera, but also this penchant for us to silently endure and unequivocally protect.
I asked Treva to talk about the ways her book presents Black women, not just as those who experience violence, but as full and complex people.
So when I first thought and dreamt up this book, it was all violence. And I was like, you know, that's not all that Black girls do. That's not all that Black women experience. We create joy. We love on each other. We affirm one another. I can tell you when I'm walking down the street and I'll just hear a Black woman like, yes, shoulder. I mean, it'll be the most random but affirming statements. And so I know our power to love, to fight, to struggle, to engage, to seek and create better worlds, to imagine other worlds was possible. And so I thought about, and I talk about in the book, and citing amazing, amazing prison police abolitionist, activist organizer, Miriam Kaba, about the discipline of hope and how that shapes so much of how Black women show up in the world. That's faith in us, hope for us, love between us, among us, and a love we have for a world we've yet to see made possible. But we keep creating that magic in the things that we do, in the ways we show up for one another, in the ways that we create, in the ways that we dance, draw, sing, love, argue. all of it is present there. And that's what I'm fighting for. I wouldn't want to do this accounting without showing what's on the other side of that and what's possible when we actually embrace the power of Black women, girls, and gender expansive folks in this war against injustice, like an injustice here, like not just injustice, but this perpetual condition of unjust circumstances, unjust death, premature death, unlivable living. These are the kinds of things that I wanted to highlight and show the living, breathing, dynamic ways that the women, even I talk about who are victims to fatal violence in the book, lived prior to that moment. And so having these little details about the things they loved, who they were in community with, who loved them, who they loved, was so important to me, other than just noting them as a victim of violence. They were also a person who loved and experienced the world in unique ways that also warrants our understanding and grappling with.
I can't have you here and not ask you about bell hooks.
To say I wouldn't be here without her would be an understatement. As a thinker, as a writer, I remember being introduced to her in college at Oberlin, which she had such a profound relationship with. I've had the fortune of encountering her on many occasions, and in Ohio specifically, where I am. And it just, we have so much from her, but it is missing the thing of missing that person that gone too soon, that premature death, this person who gave so much to the world, that gave me a language to begin thinking about the interconnected forces shaping the lives of people like me. And that love was so central to her work.
Treva Lindsay is an associate professor in the Department of Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies at The Ohio State University. Treva's book, America Goddamn, Violence, Black Women, and the Struggle for Justice, is still forthcoming, but it is currently available for pre-order wherever you get your books.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC. Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
Hey, y'all, I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Now, folks have been asking me, hey, where's your Takeaway deep dive co-host, Dorian Warren? Don't worry. Dorian and I will still be deep diving some big topics in 2022. But Dorian's taking a little time off to be with family during this holiday season. And one thing I know for sure that Dorian will be doing during this vacay is reading. As the president of a national nonprofit, a new daddy, and my regular co-pilot here on The Takeaway, Dorian is all kinds of busy. So recently I asked him if he's even found the time to read in recent months.
It is usually late at night after the baby is asleep, and in between catching up on the news and then shutting it off, I turn to books. I've always turned to books from a very young age, and it is my solace. It is the way that I try to find meaning and make meaning of the world. And so I always have a stack of books, you know, next to my nightstand or on my nightstand. I'm always reading in all hours of the night.
I know you're kind of at that early toddler stage where you can't even hardly hold a book in your hand without baby kind of snatching it out. But I'm wondering, does baby get a chance to see you reading? Are you like you and your partner? Are you all modeling? Part of what we do in the world is sit down with a book.
Yes, 100%. And I have to say, at 14 months, she already has a love of reading, even though she can't read yet, because she sees me. Now she's walking, so she'll sometimes make her way into my office, and I have just books. I have bookshelves everywhere, and she sees me reading, and she comes over, and she'll pull a book off the shelf and start to, you know, turn the pages, and just out of curiosity. And, you know, I think she's wondering, how is this sort of big adult book different than my books? And she loves all her books. We have like dozens and dozens of books all over our house because she's already just learned from observing us.
Okay, so you love reading, you're teaching baby girl to love reading. What, though, are you actually reading? And what are your kind of suggestions for this sort of end of the year moment when sometimes the world slows down just enough that we can, in fact, pick up a book?
So I have three books on my list, Melissa. The first is a memoir by a dear friend named Michael Tubbs, the former mayor of Stockton, called The Deeper the Roots. And I could not put this book down when I started because it's such a beautiful meditation on his life journey. And especially, it's sort of an ode to all the Black women in his life. And so it's just a beautifully written story and journey of how he went from this kid born in poverty in Stockton, California, to becoming mayor of that city. And I just couldn't put it down. And it really resonated with a lot of my own story because of all the Black women in my life, my mother, my grandmother, my aunties. The second book is a book by Heather McGee, The Sum of Us. And I really appreciated Heather's ability to make accessible a lot of social science research around inequality in this country. And in this book, she talks about this beautiful, it's actually a beautiful but also alarming metaphor of the drained pool, of how in resistance to the civil rights movement, white Southerners in particular, but all around the country, literally drained public swimming pools in terms of not allowing access for Black folks. She helps us make sense of why that's the case, but then also gives us a vision around what does solidarity mean? What does it mean in 2021, 2022? How do we all benefit from a framework of abundance instead of the zero-sum politics that has defined really the entire history of this country? And then I can't resist, last but not least, because we were talking about my baby girl. Of course, I read a lot of children's books. I mean, a lot. Goodnight Moon is what I read every single night. But I love this book by the Indigenous author Julie Flett called We All Play. And it's such a lovely story of the interaction of children with the natural world and particularly with animals and just the ability and the, you know, teaching kids what play and imagination is all about, often something that we lose as we get older. So those are my three. The deeper the roots, the sum of us, we all play. I would highly recommend those for your reading list.
I want to thank my Deep Dive co-host, Dorian Warren, for joining me and for these great book recommendations.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Odoo. Odoo is a fully integrated business management software solution designed to help run your company efficiently. To learn more, go to odoo.com/takeaway. That's odoo.com/takeaway.
My name is Caitlin Greenidge, and I'm the author of Liberty, and I'm also features director at Harper's Bazaar.
Liberty is a work of historical fiction, but its central theme and characters resonate with significance in our current moment. So I started by asking Caitlin about the impetus for the novel.
Liberty is about a young woman. She is a free Black girl born in Brooklyn in the 1850s. And her mother is quite a remarkable person. Her mother is one of the first Black female doctors in the state. So she's growing up sort of an immense privilege and disconnect from the lived realities of many Black people at that time during slavery. But her life runs the course from the Civil War into Reconstruction. And the novel sort of follows her over that path, over her figuring out where she fits into this wider world, where her mother fits into this wider world, how her identity as a dark-skinned Black woman of privilege fits into this world and worlds where she often isn't able to be seen by the people around her. And she lives in an all Black enclave in Brooklyn that's based on Weeksville, which was a real place. And then she ends up going to a Black college, one of the, an HBCU sort of in its very early days, in its first couple days. And then she marries a man from Haiti and she moves to Haiti sort of looking for this dream of a Black nationalist homeland. And then is very quickly faced with the reality of living in the country. But she also falls in love with the country too. So that's sort of the scope of the novel, but it's also sort of around these bigger questions about what freedom means, what motherhood and looks like, what we sort of owe to each other in terms of love and care and community.
Talk to us about Susan Smith McKinney Stewart, who is the kind of historical insight or inspiration, I know, initially for the novel.
Sure. So Dr. Susan Smith McKinney Stewart was the first Black female doctor in New York State. She grew up in that community that I mentioned earlier, Weeksville, which was a free Black community founded by her father was one of the founders. It's a really remarkable place. There's a history museum still there now dedicated to that community. I worked there for many years. And Weeksville was a place that was founded specifically to create Black political power in Brooklyn. So it tended to attract people who were super invested and intrigued in this question of black politics, abolitionism, activism, just real sort of a dynamic space. So she grew up in this really special space, managed to get into medical school as a black woman. There's some rumors that she was passing, but she always insisted that she made it very clear that she came from Weeksville, a black community. She ended up opening up a hospital in the community called the Brooklyn Women and Children's Homeopathic Hospital that treated both black and white patients. She had this really illustrious career. When I was working at Weeksville, I worked on their oral history project. And so I had the privilege of interviewing one of her descendants. And I thought that the interview was sort of going to be about how wonderful her ancestor was because she's so impressive. And it was that. But her descendant, who was this woman named Ellen Hawley, who some of your listeners may recognize that name because she was a famous black soap opera actress herself. But she really sort of reiterated the more complicated story that her family was reckoning with, which is that the doctor's daughter was this young girl raised in sort of this culture of black excellence post-Civil War, married a young man from Haiti, moved down to Haiti, and the marriage turned abusive pretty quickly and fell apart. And so the doctor, Dr. Susan Smith McKinney Stewart, had to figure out how to get her daughter out of this situation in turn of the century Haiti to get her to New York. And if you can imagine, this is a time period where, you know, the idea of abuse or domestic violence or anything like those aren't really concepts that people understand to the extent that they understand it today. And then on top of it, because they came from this really rarefied space of Black achievement and Black excellence, both of them were very acutely aware that ending this marriage was going to be seen not only as a personal failure, but could be read sort of as a failure of Blackness in some sort of way. And indeed, for the rest of her life, Anna McKinney, the daughter who had married into this family in Haiti and then had to escape, for the rest of her life after she left Haiti, she would get letters from her in-laws sort of telling her, you know, you're ruining our whole experiment of Black liberation by not being a part of this abusive marriage, by not coming back and staying with your husband no matter what. And by you choosing sort of your own safety and your children's safety, you're at direct odds with Black progress, essentially. And so I was so struck by, you know, the way that was framed and that really wrenching sort of choice and understanding. And to me, it opened up all of these questions about, you know, defining yourself as an individual versus part of a community. What does individual freedom look like? And when you are free, what are your responsibilities to those around you?
One, thank you for being the novel rather than just the historical narrative, certainly based in the historical narrative, but giving us some room to play with the character. So talk to me about, for you, as you were managing as a person from a family of bizarre levels of excellence and accomplishment, how did you want to take Liberty? How did you want to take her through this process of thinking through individualism, thinking through freedom, thinking through excellence?
Yeah, I mean, I'm so thank you for sort of that glimpse into sort of how you were approaching it, because I think very similarly to you, you know, and I think probably it's a similar experience for most Black people, is that you are, you know, I don't know how the way things are going, I don't know how I'm going to say this for my daughter's generation, but you are in your generation is afforded certain more rights and freedoms than the generation before you. And so you are talking to people and you're raised often by people who understand something really elemental about the world that can be really hard to reckon with the world that's sort of right in front of you that you're growing into. And so I really wanted to explore that tension because I think it's a tension that sort of exists across generations and informs so many people's choices across generations. A really important thing to me when I was writing the novel is that I knew this was going to be a novel that took place in the past, specifically during the Civil War in Reconstruction. And I knew this was going to be about a Black family. But it was really important to me that the characters don't, that the scenes and the characters and their concerns don't have anything really to do with whiteness in really any sort of way. They don't really encounter white people that often. There aren't really many scenes of sort of direct oppression from white people. All of the questions that are coming up for Liberty come from questions of how we define and live Blackness with other Black people in our communities. Like, how do we actually determine and sort of and build for ourselves? What does that actually look like? And so I think that question gets made anew with each generation, because each generation sort of feels like there's that something could be more possible for theirs. And yet your parents and your grandparents are sort of telling you, like, in the deepness, heaviness of my bones, I know on a certain level that's not true. And I'm trying to save you some time so that you don't spend most of your time trying to fight or battle or box with these things that are inevitable, and that you can sort of focus on these other things to be the great thing that you want to be. And negotiating between those two things is, I think, something that a lot of us live with.
Whiteness is not encountered, but color certainly is. Want to walk us through that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So really early on in the book, this question of colorism, when I was researching, came up. Because as I mentioned a little bit earlier, the woman that the doctor is based on, Dr. Susan Smith McKinney Stewart, she was certainly light enough that she could pass. And there's sort of a feeling that that's how she was able to get into medical school, that it was more a lie of omission rather than sort of like a direct attempt to pass. Her daughter, the daughter that Liberty is based on, was light enough so that her nickname was Peaches. And if I, you know, I saw some photographs of her in Haiti, and it's clear that she was also light-skinned. But I decided to make Liberty the character darker than her mother and dark-skinned, because I felt, number one, that for the time period, you know, this is a right after the Civil War and into Reconstruction, this question of color becomes sort of even more fraught for Black people, because, you know, during slavery, you had the people who were slaves and then free Black people, or free people of color, as they were called in some areas. And the distinction was legal, like you were either a slave or you weren't. Some people who were very light skinned were slaves, but they were still technically slaves. There was no real way for you to cross over. And suddenly, you know, with the end of slavery and that sort of brief moment of relative freedom before sort of the backlash that came down on Black people, there was this sense that you could sort of cross over the color line, or cross back and forth over the color line. And I wanted to explore that tension, sort of that new world that would have been open to people. And the flip side of that is that after slavery ended, there is a whole class of people who previously were considered free people of color, extremely light-skinned, you know, in many cases, you know, would have looked to us today to be white people. And those people emphatically said, no, we are Black. We've lived as people of color for this whole time before. Because slavery is over, we're not going to now suddenly pass as white. And in fact, we're going to try and become like a real driver in Black communities, like you know, run for office and try and figure out how to tackle this sort of rising of legal segregation. So both of those things were super interesting to me, and I just wanted to, and you know, as a novelist, you're sort of looking for places where drama exists and where there can be real conflict, and that seemed like a really natural place to go to.
Yeah, I so appreciated you walking right into that. Let me just, on a final sort of point here, you know, again, I was saying I so appreciated that you went with historical fiction here, but I'm wondering for you, because it was actually sort of a big year for historical fiction, if you have a sense beyond your own sort of work as a creator, as an artist, but understanding that within this sort of moment of a desire to reckon with our histories, but also to do so in the format of novel. So I'm just kind of wondering what makes you drawn to historical fiction as a way of storytelling.
Sure. I mean, you know, I'm a creature of the archives. I've worked at Black historical sites since I was 16 years old. you know, I just love our history so much, and having worked with it for so long and had the privilege of talking to all people from all walks of life about it for so long, is that I love also that our history is so varied and strange and interesting. You know, one of the things that was really frustrating when I worked sometimes at Black history sites is sort of the demand that our history or the stories that we told follow the very specific beats of like this Black person overcame something, got into an all white space. And that's what we mean when we say Black history. We're talking about Black people who made it into a white space and they count as history. And I think that's such, you know, it, and I would get that definition either conscious or unconscious from a lot of people. And when I worked at a place like Weeksville, which was, you know, focused on a Black community, talking about people across different classes within a Black community, it often, and everyday history of people in a Black community, there was also often sort of like this feeling from some visitors of like, why is this history? And then, but for many more people being like, this is exactly what I'm looking for. Like this is what makes history come alive for me, is that I can see some of these people grappling with the same questions and things that I'm grappling with today, that I'm often told must be just because, you know, I'm an ungrateful kid living in 2021. And if I was living back then, I would, you know, have more sense not to question these things. But when I actually look at the record, I see people were questioning things throughout our history, and that these sort of conflicts and disagreements and all these different ways to be Black have existed for as long as we've been here.
It's a trick, man, to raise a free Black kid, maybe particularly a free Black girl. You just better know they're gonna work out their freedom on you first, mama and daddies. It is more than a notion. So I guess maybe, you know, I love that, because maybe it is, it's for me also knowing, as parent that, that this isn't just about, oh, these Z's or these millennials, right? That, these are the central questions of who we are and of what we want to be. Caitlin Greenidge, thank you so much for this book.
Oh, thank you for this conversation. This was such a delight. Thank you.
What does it mean to be a father, a mother? Is it possible to just be a parent without that parenting being gendered? What does it mean to be a man, a woman, to live a self-determined life, to have a little fun? These are just some of the questions Tori Peters tackles in her best-selling novel, Detransition Baby. Yes. I know. The book's been out for almost a year, but it's been a tough year. And in case you haven't gotten around to reading it, take a little time to sit down with this book before we slide on into 2022. Detransition Baby upends expectations of gender and genre in a thoroughly engaging 21st century tale of love. I recently spoke with Tori Peters, author of Detransition Baby, about her book, and she walked through the storyline for those of us who were a little late to the Tori Peters party this year.
It's the story of Reese, who you can think of as sort of like Fleabag, but trans and in Brooklyn. And the action kicks off when her ex, Ames, who used to be a trans woman named Amy, detransitions and then gets his boss, Katrina, pregnant, and then asks Reese if perhaps the three of them can form an unconventional family together. And that's a lot, but it's actually just the first chapter. And then just like it goes from there.
So let's walk back for some folks. What does it mean to detransition? And why'd you choose a detransitioning story?
Well, to detransition it's the opposite of transition, where somebody goes through a gender transition, in this case, to become a woman, and then decides to detransition back to being a man. And the reason I decided to write about it is that detransition is actually a pretty loaded concept inside of the trans community. It's often been sort of weaponized against trans people to say, oh, you've made a mistake, or don't transition because you could have regrets. Look at these detransitioners. And I decided to kind of take it back and tell a story of a detransitioner and why people detransition, which often isn't because of regret, but because life is really hard when you are a trans woman often, and it's the obstacles that oftentimes you're trying to avoid when people detransition, not that you got your gender wrong. And I wanted to write a book from that perspective.
It also suggests to me, and happy to have you push or push back around any of this, that so much of what the novel is doing is just suggesting fluidity, right? That in certain ways, the notion of transitioning or detransitioning is dichotomous or you know, sort of in these neat, although certainly messy, but neat boxes. And that instead, part of what you're giving us is you know, fluidity around the notion of family, fluidity around the notion of self, fluidity around the notions of gender, and certainly even fluidity around the notions of parenting, and even not just of parenting, but specifically of motherhood.
Yeah, I think you said that really well. I mean, and the fact that, you know, so much of the way we talk about this stuff is often through terms and etiquette. And I think a novel's a space where you have enough room to sort of muddy that up a little bit. So it's hard to say whether Ames is a woman or a man. And yet oftentimes through the book, I use he pronouns for Ames, or sometimes I'll use she pronouns for Amy. And, you know, it's confusing. And sometimes it's meant to be difficult because just we don't often have boxes for this where you can just say, oh yes, this person is at this stage of their life. And so you say this, but in fact, usually the language isn't quite perfect. And so to write a book about that messiness, about that muddiness, where there isn't always the right language, was part of what was interesting for me, both in terms of gender and in terms of exactly, as you say, motherhood, where the question of what does it mean to be a mother? Is it a biological thing? Is it a social relationship? Can you be a mother with people, you know, in your community? Can you be a mother with, you know, people who you have no biological tie to, or even, you know, a social tie like adoption? What is motherhood? And in what ways does it function? These were really important questions for me as a trans woman, specifically because typical motherhood isn't often available to trans women. And yet, I think we're constantly mothering each other.
Talk to me a little more about a problem that I think also so many marginalized authors have about, you know, how to ensure that it's read as a story, as a book, as a novel, and not as like a political treatise.
Yeah, you know, I didn't want people to read it in order to sort of learn something about trans people. That wasn't what I was trying to do. Nor was I trying to create perfect trans characters. Like, I didn't actually want the burden of representation where you say, well, this story of Reese is a stand-in for all trans women. No, Reese has very particular problems for her particular personality. And, you know, that I wanted the same tools that any other writer has, where you get to have flawed characters, you get to be funny, you get to make fun of yourself. And I wanted to be able to use those in a sort of trans context. And so my hope with this book is sure, you might learn something, but you're not learning it because somebody's lectured you. You're learning it because you've gone on a journey with these characters. You have empathy for these characters. And my hope is that you actually see, you know, I would like cis women to see their own motherhood reflected in Reese's motherhood, their own sort of I think oftentimes about the parallel between transition and divorce and what it means to start your life over as a woman in your 30s or 20s or 40s. And that there's actually all of these ways that my experience and other women's experiences sort of cross over. And I would like people to approach this book not as I'm going to learn about the other, but oftentimes I'm going to experience something about myself through this novel, the same way that like every novel that I enjoy, I'm not doing it to learn something. I'm doing it to have a sort of emotional experience through humor, through sadness, through joy. And, you know, that's really what I wanted to offer readers with this book.
Let me just ask this, because this is a book club. What are you reading or what are you gifting this year if you're gifting books?
Right now, I'm reading Our Country Friends by Gary Steingart, which people had told me was one of the first great pandemic novels. And so I'm only halfway through it, but I am going to be very interested in the art that comes out of this moment. And this being one of the first that is trying to take it on directly. I think there's a question of how do we actually talk about it? And then in what ways will we see the effects like reverberate stylistically in so many other books to come? I had some favorite books also by trans people this year. There was a book called Daryl by Jackie S. that I am really excited about. And then there's a book called King Kong Theory by, I'm going to say her name with a terrible accent, Virginie Despentes. The French writer Virginia Despentes is how I would say it with an American accent. It's like fire to hold in your hands. It's just an so passionate, so unafraid.
Tori Peters is the author of the novel Detransition Baby. Tori, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's it for our show. We really hope you enjoyed it and that you took lots of notes. So I want to thank our guests, Constance Grady, Treva B. Lindsay, my deep dive partner, Dorian Warren, Caitlin Greenidge, and Tori Peters. Okay, if you missed any of those titles, don't worry. Our man, Zach, the Takeaway's digital editor, has got you covered. Just head on over to thetakeaway.org to find the authors and titles we discussed today. And of course, call us with your show ideas or your suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or as always, send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Meet us back here tomorrow.